All right. Well, does everybody have one of these handouts? Okay, good. We'll go over that in just a minute. But just a little update on what's been going on. My world is moving again. And 2 years ago, I was living here in Watford, and I bought the farm from my sister that our family has owned since 1978. And we've been there for just 2 years, and we were looking to move. But right after Christmas, we were with my wife's sister, and she's in a nursing home. And we quartered our house for right after Christmas and had a great time. We're taking her back to this nursing home. We go to this nursing home, and it's not the greatest. You know, it's okay, but we're driving home, and my wife is thinking, man, I don't want to end up in a nursing home, you know. And then she remembers, oh, wait a minute, my daughter lives, she lives in Sparta. And there you see where Sparta, there's Grand Rapids. Sparta's about 15, 20 minutes north of Grand Rapids. Her and her husband had found this multifamily house. It's a main house with 4 bedrooms and 2 baths, and then they added an addition with 2 units. And each unit has a kitchen, a living room, a bedroom, and a bath. And so they invited us to go in with them because, separately we couldn't afford the house, but to go in with them and then live with them and share, and buy the house. And so we went and checked it out, and long story short, we decided to sell our house, and we just closed on it last Wednesday. We sold the house. We have a month now to get out, so we're living there right now until we move. It's kind of weird being in the house when we don't even know it. But then tomorrow we're going to sign the papers to buy the house in Sparta, and then, Lord willing, move sometime next week. But another reason I'm real excited about moving there is, how many of you have you heard it's called the Dragon Trail, the new bike trail. Now, when I lived in Waterford, there's Pioneer State Park, and they got a really nice mountain bike trail around there, and I biked that a couple times, and that's one of the nicest trails in America. But this Dragon Trail that they're building is going to be just about 15 minutes north of Sparta, where we're living. And the reason they call it the Dragon Trail is, if you see the map there, it looks like a dragon, doesn't it? So that's why they call it the Dragon Trail. It goes around, it's the Hardy Dam, and it's in Croton, Nuevo area. And it's going to be, right now they've got, I think like 27 miles are completed, and sometime next year it's supposed to be fully completed. It's going to be a little over 40 miles, and it's going to be one of the premier bike trails in the whole country. And they are expecting millions of people to come to visit and do, biking and hiking around this trail. And that's why I'm really excited, because when I was in Chicago, I was hosting Israelis. Israelis come to, and they lived with me in my house. And why is to tour Chicago? And I'm hoping then to get many Israelis to come and, see the bike trail, tour the, hike and bike around the trail. They can go see Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids is considered, I don't know if you guys knew this, Grand Rapids is the beer capital of America. They are literally, it's officially Beer City, USA. They have more breweries than any city in the country. And, Grand Rapids used to be known for printing Bibles. Now they're known for brewing beer. And they're also a top 20 foodie city. So I signed up recently on this website, and I want to show this to you because you guys can do this too. You can sign. This site is run by Chosen People Ministries, and if you would be interested, if you have a guest room in your house, you can sign up to host Israelis, and you're in a great location to do it. And why is because you're close to Detroit. Detroit is a major. It's a tourist city. And there might be Israelis that would want to come and, and visit Detroit. And so if you'd be interested, go to this hostisraelis.com, and then you would just sign up, learn more, or apply today. And they are getting a network. Now, you have to be a believer in Jesus to do this. Because they're getting a network of believers, not only across America, but around the world, to host Israelis. And when the Israelis come, they will give you literature in Hebrew New Testaments for you to give, and then to be able to share your faith with the Israelis. And if you were to click on Michigan, if you were on their little app and click on the state of Michigan, right now I'm the only one in the whole state of Michigan that has signed up to do this. So you guys, we need some more people, all right? You can join me on this. So that's why I'm really excited then about moving to the Sparta area. And then I can continue. I'd love to keep coming back, speaking here. It's only a couple hour drive. I drive 4 or 5 hours to speak in churches. But I'm also, with being close to Grand Rapids, there's a train from Grand Rapids that goes right into Chicago. I'm hoping to get back down to Chicago. You know, I've been in Chicago for 22 years and hoping to renew that some more. Now, this morning I want to speak to you on the trial of Jesus. You know, we're coming up to Easter and Passover. And what I'm giving you this morning comes from the book that I've been recommending many, many times, Yeshua, which is the Hebrew way to say Jesus, the life of Messiah Jesus from a Messianic Jewish perspective. I believe this is the best book that's ever been written about the life of Jesus. I know some of you, how many of you purchased this book? Did you get a seat? Or you got the other one, right? Nobody yet. You guys got it? Okay, your dad got it? Okay, good. So you can go on his website. Really, I think the best book ever written on the life of Jesus. I tell believers all the time, if you read this book, you're going to know more about the life of Jesus than probably 95% of all Christians. And what you have in this handout, take a look at this. This comes from Dr. Fruchtenbaum's book, The Life of the Messiah. And this is the 22 rules that were broken at the trial of Jesus. Now remember, when Jesus was doing his ministry, what were the scribes and Pharisees complaining about? All that you heard it all the time, right? Jesus, you're breaking the Sabbath. Jesus, you're breaking our rules and our laws. Well, Jesus never broke one of the laws of Moses. Dan and I were talking about this morning. You were talking about the beatitude. You guys are in Matthew 5. He said, Jesus said, I didn't come to destroy the law of Moses. I came to fulfill it. Jesus kept every one of the laws of Moses, the jot and the tittle, every law. But what Jesus did not keep are the laws that the scribes and Pharisees added to the law of Moses, and they added literally thousands and thousands of laws. Jesus didn't keep, in fact, many times, he purposely broke those laws to show them their hypocrisy and to show them that these laws were not from God. These were their own man-made laws. And over again, Jesus, you're not keeping our laws. Isn't it ironic? At the trial of Jesus, they had to break 22 of their own laws. Exactly why they wanted to crucify Jesus, they did. And let's look at them. Rule number one, there was to be no arrest by the religious authorities that was affected by a bribe. Well, they gave Jesus the bribe. Number two, no steps of criminal proceedings were to occur after sunset. Well, the trial started in the before sunrise. Judges or members of the Sanhedrin were not allowed to participate in an arrest, and there they were, arresting Jesus. There were no trials before the morning sacrifice. They broke that one. There would be no secret trials, only public, and they start out in secret, which we're going to see. Number six, the Sanhedrin trials could only be conducted in the Hall of Judgment in the temple compound. And we're going to see again, they started out in Caiaphas' house. Rule seven, during the trial, the defense had the first word before prosecutors could present the accusations. They completely skipped over that. Number eight, all could argue in favor of acquittal, but all could not argue in favor of conviction. Number nine, there would be two or three witnesses. Their testimonies had to agree. They obviously didn't do that. Number ten, there would be no allowance for the accused to testify against himself. Number 11, the high priest was forbidden to rend his garments. And the high priest broke that. Number 12, judges could not initiate charges. They could only investigate charges brought to them. 13, the accusation of blasphemy was only valid if the name of God itself was pronounced. Now, they accused Jesus of blasphemy, but he did not pronounce the name of God. So that was a law they broke. Excuse me. A person could not be condemned solely on the basis of his own words. The verdict could not be announced at night. Number 16, page 2, in the case of capital punishment, the trial and guilty verdict could not occur at the same time. It had to be separated by at least 24 hours. Number 17, the voting for the death penalty had to be done by individual count, beginning with the youngest, so the young would not be influenced by the elder. And number 18, very interesting, a unanimous decision of guilt showed the person was innocent. So it showed there was a conspiracy. And in the trial of Jesus, they all voted against him, which meant he was innocent. Number 19, the sentence could only be pronounced 3 days after the guilty verdict. Number 20, judges were to be humane and kind. Number 21, the condemned to death was not to be scourged or beaten before his execution. 22, no trials were allowed on the eve of a Sabbath or a feast day. All 22 of those laws very obviously broken in the trial of Jesus. So let's look at it as there are actually two parts to the trial of Jesus. All right, there was a religious trial, and then there was a civil trial. Now, in the religious trial, they were looking for a different accusation. All right, it was. Is there a pointer in here? Let's see. But the religious trial. Let me just go right here. Okay, the religious trial, the charge against Jesus was blasphemy. You know, he claiming to be God. Now, they didn't bring that to the Roman trial, right? Because the Romans believed that a man could be God. In fact, the Romans believed that Caesar was God. So the charge of blasphemy wouldn't hold water in a Roman court, all right? And what we're going to see is when they brought Jesus to Pilate, they completely changed their charge, which we're going to see in a minute. So the religious trial, what they're accusing Jesus was blasphemy. And it says the band captain officers, the Jews, took Jesus, and this, again, was at nighttime and breaking their laws, and they led him away to Annas first. Now, when at this time, Caiaphas was the high priest. But they didn't take him to Caiaphas first. They took him to Annas. Now, why did they take him to Annas first? Well, Annas at one point was the high priest of Israel. And in the law of Moses, it says that the high priest was supposed to be high priest. Does anyone remember how long a high priest was supposed to be high priest?
Where?
Right, exactly, right. For life. It was for until he died. But the Romans didn't like that. Okay, the Romans thought, oh, that's too much power in one guy's hands, all right? So the Romans deposed Annas, and then Annas would put in somebody else. Now Annas had a few sons, and Caiaphas was actually the son-in-law of Annas. So Caiaphas could, you know, use Annas could use Caiaphas kind of like his puppet, because he's the son-in-law. So the Jews, they really viewed Annas as the high priest. So they take him there first. And notice it says he is the father-in-law to Caiaphas. Caiaphas was actually, the one the Romans considered and appointed, and believed was the high priest. Which it says he was the high priest the same year. The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. And so here what they're trying to do is get Jesus to self-accuse him, you know, himself. And what does Jesus say? I spoke openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue, in the temple, where the Jews always resort. I in secret said nothing. So it was not the responsibility of Jesus to accuse himself, right? If they had a problem, they were supposed to bring that. They were supposed to have a defense attorney to bring, or I'm sorry, a prosecutor rather, to bring what the charge was. But here, they're breaking one of his laws, and Jesus points that out. And then what happens when he has spoken? One of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Do you answer the high priest like that?" And Jesus answered, "If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me?" Jesus is pointing out to them the fact that they are breaking their own laws. And what do? They hit him on the face. Now, in a court proceeding, if you hit somebody in the face, you are supposed to be fined 4 denarii. A denarii was a day's wage, so 4 days' wages. What's a day's wage today? Roughly $200. Of course, it depends if you're, you know, someone like the average person or someone like, you know, Warren Buffett or whatever, right? But say $200, it's like $800. And then they're going to go later, and they're going to hit them with their strike with the palms of their hands and in their face, etc. So then they take him to the Sanhedrin. Now, the Sanhedrin had a building here. This is the temple, and they met in this little room right here, just off of the temple compound. And the Sanhedrin was made up of 24 chief priests, and these were Sadducees. And remember, the Sadducees only believed in the Torah, and they did not believe in life after death. 24 elders, or Pharisees, and 22 scribes. Scribes were also Pharisees, and then there was a high priest for a total of 71. Now, then, after Annas, they brought him to the house of Caiaphas. And again, this is breaking one of their laws. The trial was supposed to be done in public, but here they are at the house of Caiaphas in private. And they bring conflicting witnesses. One witness says, I heard him say, I will destroy the temple. And the other one said, well, I heard him say, I'm able to destroy the temple. So they couldn't find two people that agreed with each other. So again, breaking one of their own laws. So as Jesus stands before Caiaphas, it says, the high priest rose and answered and said unto him, answer you nothing. What is it these witnesses say against you? But Jesus held his peace. Again, it was not the job of Jesus to, you know, point out anything that he had done wrong. And he hadn't done anything wrong. But it was their job to point out what he was done wrong. And Jesus is like, hey, you know, do your job. So finally, the high priest, he gets very frustrated. And he says, I adjure you by the living God. And so he's placing Jesus under an oath. Now, when you're placed under an oath in a Jewish court, that means you must answer. So he says, I adjure you. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. And so now Jesus has to answer. And so he says, you have said. And what he's saying there is, that's the way the King James reads, thou hast said. And what he's saying is, yes, I am. And he says, nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power, coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. Now again, remember, one of the 22 rules was, the charge of blasphemy could only be brought if the name of God was used. Jesus did not use the name of God. He said, sitting at the right hand of power. Now, power was like another, there he's talking about God. When Jesus returns, he's going to be returning at, you know, he's going to be ruling at the right hand of God. So power is talking about God, but he did not use the name of God. And therefore, when the priest rent his clothes, he broke one of their laws. It was not blasphemy. And then he said, what further need have we witnesses? Well, they're supposed to have two witnesses, but they can't even find two witnesses. And then they answered and said, he's guilty of death. And then they spit in his face, buffeted him, and others smote him with the palms of their hands. Now remember, okay, just a little while ago, I said if you hit somebody with your fist in the face, that was a fine of 4 denarii, 4 days' wages. However, as it goes on to say, if you slap somebody, that was actually a worse fine. That was an insult, and that was a fine of 200 denarii. And if you spit at someone in the face, that was a fine of 400. That's over a year's wage and salary. But, of course, there's no record, you know, of any of these people being fined. Now, in Luke 22, it says, as soon as it was day. So all of this is going on before daylight, which, again, is breaking one of their 22 laws. The trials had to be conducted in public and in, you know, during the day. And so they're trying to show some resemblance of, you know, legality here. So they started all over again in the daytime. And the elders of the people and the chief priests and scribes came together, and they led him into their council, saying, are you the Christ? So at this point, they go back to the public, and they're meeting here now in the hall in the Sanhedrin at this point because it is now daylight. And they're trying to show that, you know, they're trying to be legal, but, you know, even though they're not. And so officially they say, "Are you the Christ? Tell us." And he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer to me, nor let me go. Hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God." And so again, his answer is, "Yes, I am the Christ." And then they said, "Are you the Son of God?" And he said, "You say that I am." And again, it means yes, you said it. And they said, "What other further need have we of his witnesses, for we are ourselves have heard of his own mouth." So this ends the religious trial. And the charge is, there's three phases to each trial. Three phases to the religious trial, three phases to the civil trial. And at the end of this religious trial, he is charged with blasphemy. Now, at this point, they are going to take him to Pontius Pilate, and that will begin the civil trial. And at this point, they are going to bring in their star witness, Judas Iscariot. But what happened to Judas? Yeah. He, at this point, at this time, has hung himself. Now, Matthew 27:5 says, at this point, when Judas realized, you know, Jesus was accused and convicted by the Sanhedrin, he realizes that he has made a major mistake. And Matthew 25 says, he threw the pieces of silver in the temple, departed, and went and hanged himself. Now, that seems to conflict with how Judas, Acts 1:18 says how Judas died. Acts 1:18 says, "This man Judas purchased a field with the wages of iniquity. Falling headlong, he burst open in the middle of this, and all his entrails gushed out." So, what is the solution? Well, actually, both happened, all right? When Judas realized that Jesus was convicted, he went to his house, which would have been within the city walls of Jerusalem. Okay, this is what Jerusalem would have looked like in the time of Jesus. It's a really cool model of the city of Jerusalem they have when you go to Israel at the Holy Land Hotel, and I've been to this a couple times. So Judas would have hanged himself within the walls in his house, within the walls of the city of Jerusalem. And then once his body was found, because it was the Passover, his body then they would have taken and they would have thrown it over the city wall in this area, and that valley there, known as the Valley of Hinnom or the Valley of Gehenna, which Jesus used as an illustration of hell. Actually, the lake of fire. It was in that valley that the kings of Israel used to sacrifice their children to idols. And there were always fires burning. They would keep, you know, the fires eat the idol, this metal idol up, and place the baby on the glowing red hot arms of this idol, and the baby would be sacrificed and burned to death. And also kind of interesting that it was in this same area where when the Romans, 40 years later in 70 AD, marched against Jerusalem, and when they took the city, they killed over 1 million Jewish people, and their dead bodies, we know from history, would have been stacked up in the same area, the Valley of Hinnom, the same area where Judas, after his body was thrown out over the walls, then his guts would have gushed all out. So as they bring Jesus to Pilate, Pilate is ready, all right? He knows, you know, he gave permission and all that to the soldiers to accompany Judas to the arrest of Jesus. So Pilate's not taken off guard. He knows there's going to be a trial. And he goes out to him. He's ready for it. And he says, "What accusation bring you against this man?" Now, they're in a bind here because their star witness, Judas, has killed himself. So they're caught off guard. You know, they're trying to come up with things. And they answered and said, "If he were not a malefactor, you know, if he wasn't, you know, guilty, we would not have delivered him up to you, unto you." And Pilate said, "Take him and judge him according to your law." You know, Pilate's not going to kill somebody unless he has a legitimate accusation. And so he's not just going to take their word for it. And then the Jews said to him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death. Now, essentially, we know from history that the Jewish people lost the right to put people to death in the year 30 AD, the same year that Jesus was crucified. The Romans took that right away from them, and so they were not allowed to put people to death. The only way they could put people to death was by stoning. And we see that in Acts, was it chapter 7, when they bring Stephen before him. They take Stephen out and stone him. And why could they stone Stephen? Well, probably they did that illegally. They got so upset with Stephen, they didn't care. They just took him out and stoned him. But they had lost that right in 30 A.D. But that also, John points out, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, saying, what death he should die. Jesus over and over said he was going to die by crucifixion, and that was going to fulfill messianic prophecy, so he could not be killed by stoning. So as Jesus standing, this is the place where Jesus would have stood before Pontius Pilate, and this is Roman fortress, the Antonio fortress, the Romans built as an addition onto the temple, and they would look out over the temple grounds and keep control. This is where Jesus would have stood before Pontius Pilate. So then they try, you know, the religious leaders now are trying to come up with charges against Jesus, and they began to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow converting the nation, forbidding to give tribute to Caesar. Now that's not true, is it? Remember when they brought the coin, you know, to Jesus, and they said, and you know, should we give tribute to Caesar? What did Jesus say? Give the Caesar things to Caesar, give the God things to God. Jesus never said, don't give tribute to Caesar. So this was an outright lie. And then saying that he himself is Christ a king. Now, that would be of concern to Rome if Jesus was in competition with Caesar. And so what their accusation is, that Jesus is in competition to Caesar, and he wants to lead a rebellion against Rome. So once Pilate has this accusation, this charge, he now then goes back in and begins to talk to Jesus. And he says to Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? Are you in competition with Rome? And Jesus said, the King James reads, sayest thou this thing of thyself, or that others tell it thee of me? What he's asking Pilate is, are you asking this from a Jewish point of view, or are you asking this from a Roman point of view? Because it's very important how he's going to answer the question. What does Pilate say? Am I a Jew? Your own nation and priests have delivered you unto me. What have you done? And so Pilate responded by saying, look, I'm not Jewish. I'm not asking from a Jewish point of view. I'm a Roman. I'm asking from a Roman point of view. And what did Jesus answer? My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight. That should not be delivered to Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. Excuse me. Now, amillennialists, Christians who don't believe in the millennium, they love this verse. You know, when they drop their Bible, it folds open, falls open to this verse, right? And they say, oh, see, Jesus says right here, he's not going to come, he's not going to set up a kingdom. Well, that's not what Jesus is saying at all. You know, the Bible says to be in the world, but not of the world. And there are hundreds, even probably thousands of prophecies that talk about the return and setting up of the messianic kingdom on earth. And what Jesus is saying is, his kingdom is not of this world system. And it's not hence, it's not going to be set up right now, but it will be set up. Jesus said, talk about this later. Jesus said to his disciples that in Matthew 19, when he returns, they would sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Jesus never said he was not going to set up a kingdom. The kingdom is not going to be right at that moment. So Pilate says, are you a king? Jesus answered, you say I am. In other words, yeah. And to this end was I born, this cause that came in the world, I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that was of the truth hears my voice. Pilate says, what is truth? And after he said that, he went on the Jews, and he says, I find no fault in him. So this is the end of phase one of the civil trial. And Pilate concludes that Jesus is not a threat to Rome. But as they're screaming out other threats, Pilate learns that Jesus is from Galilee. He grew up, you know, he's born in Bethlehem, but he grew up in Nazareth. And Galilee was under the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas. So when he hears that, he decides to send Jesus over to Herod, who happened to be in the city of Jerusalem for Passover, because Herod was a convert to Judaism. And as soon as it says, Suning on belonged to Herod Antipas' jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was also Jerusalem at that time. Now, Herod Antipas is the son of Herod the Great. And what did Herod the Great do? Remember when Jesus was born? He's the one who had all the baby boys killed all around Jerusalem. And then Herod Antipas is the one who had John the Baptist beheaded about a year earlier. And then remember when Jesus was doing all those miracles? Herod wanted to see it. See, and he thought that Jesus was like John the Baptist reincarnated, or John the Baptist come back from the dead. He's doing all these miracles, and Herod wanted to see him. So Herod was very excited. When Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad. He was desirous to see him for a long season because he heard many things he had done. He hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. So Herod wants a magic show. And Jesus doesn't do miracles as a magic show, right? There was no purpose for him to do that. And so he doesn't answer anything about Herod. And Herod gets very upset. And it says at the end that Pilate and Herod were made friends together before they were enmity between themselves. Now, we know from history what happened here. That when Pilate was made the governor of Jerusalem and Judea and all that area, Pilate was a Roman and he didn't care about the Jewish traditions. And he had these big, huge banners brought into the city of Jerusalem. And on these banners was an emblem of Caesar the Great. And, Jewish people didn't have anything to do with idols. And this was like sacrilegious to them. And in fact, when you go to Israel today, you'll see statues around the country. They're 2,000 years old, but they all have their heads knocked off. What happened was, the religious Jews, when they saw these statues, they would go and knock the heads off of them because you're not supposed to worship idols. So these banners that Pilate brought in really upset the Jewish people, and Herod went to Rome, or he got messaged to Rome, and he said, look, we need to get these banners out of there because they're upsetting, they're going to upset the Jewish people. And Rome agreed with Herod. And so this was a fiction between Pilate and Herod, but now they are brought together over this case with Jesus, and this ends phase two of the civil trial. Now this is Herod's palace, and this is the temple. And again, Jesus is standing in trial right here before Pontius Pilate, and then Herod's palace is kind of in this area right here. So you can see it's not that far away. It might be a 10-15 minute walk to go between those two places. And here is so Herod sends Jesus back to Pontius Pilate. And by the way, we know from history that Herod Antipas, who beheaded John the Baptist and mocked Jesus, he paid for that. Because some years later, just a few years later, his wife convinced him to go to Rome and ask Rome to make him a king because she wanted to be a queen. And at that time, the Roman Caesar was a man named Caligula. Caligula was a crazy, he was absolute nuts. He was so nuts, he had a plan to make his horse a senator. Yeah, a horse. He's going to vote a horse, become one of the senators in Rome. And Caligula, when they come to be a king and queen, he banishes them and they live up the rest of their lives in abject poverty and die. Now, there was a tradition at that time to release a prisoner, whoever they desired. And there was a notable prisoner named Barabbas, which lay bound with them and made an insurrection with him, who had committed murder in the insurrection. And so, you know the story how Pilate gives the Jewish people a choice. Should I release Barabbas or Jesus? Because Pilate knew that was the reason the religious leaders wanted Jesus killed was because they were jealous of him. They were very jealous of him. And, to put it in today's perspective, it'd be kind of like telling people, do you want a choice between should I put to death someone like Billy Graham and John MacArthur or the Boston Strangler? or Charles Manson. You know, that's kind of like the choice they had. And Barabbas, very interesting name. I think I mentioned this before, but Barabbas is an Aramaic name that means son of the father. And we know from history that his first name was also Yeshua. But I think the reason the Gospels don't include that is because, you know, they're kind of confusion. Which Yeshua are you talking about? And so standing before Pilate is Yeshua, Jesus, the son of the Father, and then Barabbas, whose name was also Jesus, and his name means son of the Father. Barabbas is allowed to go free. Jesus is crucified and killed in the place of Barabbas. This is the fulfillment of Yom Kippur on the two goat ceremony. On Yom Kippur, they brought two goats to the temple. One was sacrificed, one was released and allowed to go free. And so it was. Jesus sacrificed, Barabbas is allowed to go free. As a picture of you and I. Jesus dies in our place, we are allowed to go free. But as Pilate is making them this offer, he receives a message from his wife. And she says that, leave that innocent man alone. I suffered through a terrible nightmare about him last night. And we know from church history that her name was Claudia, and that she later became a believer in Jesus. And as Pilate receives this message from his wife, isn't it interesting? It gives the religious leaders a pause and enough time to convince the people to call for Jesus to be crucified and for Barabbas to be released. So they say to Pilate, you know, if you let Jesus go, you're against Caesar. And the Romans also considered Caesar to be God. And Pilate could not afford, you know, Pilate was going a little, he's walking on thin ice here. He had some incidents in the past he couldn't afford for this to get back to Rome. And so he finally decides, you know, he washes his hands and he says, I'm innocent of his blood. But you know what? Acts chapter 4, verse 27 accuses Pilate of the crucifixion of Jesus. Just washing his hands, you know, was not enough. He could have released Jesus. And again, we know from history of Pontius Pilate, he paid for it. He was just a few years later, he was exiled and he committed suicide. And then the people say, the people answered, his blood be on us and on our children. And that also kind of happened because it was just one generation later, in 70 AD, the Romans came against Jerusalem and killed over 1 million Jewish people, the children of those who called out for the death of Jesus. And so this ends phase three of the civil trial. And of course, then he is taken to be crucified, which... a place called Golgotha in the Greek language means the place of the skull. And we know a lot of times today as Calvary. That comes from the Latin, Calvaria. And when Jesus died on the cross, he fulfills the prophecy, Psalm 22. They pierced my hands and my feet. Isaiah 53, he's led as a lamb to the slaughter. Zechariah 12:10, they shall look upon me whom they have pierced. His side was pierced. And also in Psalm 22:18. As Jesus died on the cross, the Roman soldiers gambled for his clothing. Now, there was a book written some years ago called The Passover Plot. It was written by a Jewish man who was not a believer in Jesus. And what he's saying in this book, that Jesus looked at all these prophecies about how the Messiah would suffer, and then he decides to go and get himself crucified, you know, and fulfill these prophecies. But you know what? One thing Jesus could not do, you know, he couldn't say to the Roman soldiers, hey guys, you know, you got to fulfill this prophecy for me. You know, you need to gamble for my clothing. No, that's something they did all on their own. Now, as Jesus is on the cross, there are 3 hours of darkness. He's on the cross for 6 hours, from 9 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon. From 12 noon to 3, there's 3 hours of darkness. And archaeologists have confirmed this. There's a Greek man, a scientist living by the name of Dionysus, living in Egypt, and he said he noted that the city of Heliopolis turned dark. And then Diogenes, a Greek scientist living in Egypt, wrote about this darkness when he saw it, quote, either God himself suffers at this moment or sympathizes with one who does. And it was really both, right? Jesus, God in the flesh, suffering, God the Father, sympathizing with him. And Phlegion, a Greek from Asia Minor, when he saw this eclipse, he wrote in his book, Olympians, a great and remarkable eclipse of the sun, unlike any before, turned the day into night at the sixth hour. That's 12 o'clock noon, right? Same as the Gospels say. The sun, the stars were seen, and a great earthquake shook the province, Roman province of Bithynia. And we know this also from the Gospels, that when Jesus died on the cross at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a great earthquake. And when that earthquake happened, the Bible, the scriptures say, the veil in the temple rent in two. That veil was actually 60 feet high, 30 feet wide, and it was the width of a man's hand. What they would do is every year they would add another layer to the veil. Remember the veil in the temple separated the Holy of Holies from the holy place, and it was just a curtain. But there was a tradition that every year they would add another layer to it, so that by that time it was about the thickness of a man's hand. And when Jesus died on the cross, the veil rented it, no doubt crushed, you know, fell and ripped under its own weight, but ripped at the exact time Jesus died on the cross to show that the way to God was now open. And very also interesting, these other events occurred at the death of Jesus. This is not recorded in the New Testament, but it's recorded in the Talmud, the rabbinic writings. And it talks about in the year 30 A.D., which they say would be 40 years before the temple was destroyed, that's 30 A.D., the center light of the temple menorah went out. The heavy doors of the temple that took several men to open swung open on their own accord after that earthquake. The lintel, the cross piece of the temple doorway, cracked. And the scapegoat, they would tie a red ribbon around the scapegoat on Yom Kippur, and that red ribbon would turn to white to show that God had accepted the sacrifice. Well, in 30 A.D., it stopped turning white, showing that that sacrifice was no longer needed because of the sacrifice of Jesus. And then finally, at the burial of Jesus, there's two traditional sites for the burial of Jesus. When you go to Israel today, there's one on the north side of Jerusalem right here. It's called the Garden Tomb. And this is what the Garden Tomb looks like. And then there's a more traditional one right here called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And that is run by the Roman Catholics. And the Garden Tomb is a much more, you know, very peaceful to be there. But more than likely, it is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is probably more than likely the correct location of the tomb of Jesus. And then just in conclusion, from five quick proofs for the resurrection of Jesus. Number one is the empty tomb. You know, the religious leaders had the tomb guarded by Roman soldiers. And when the disciples went up to the temple and they said, hey, he's risen, all they had to do was go to the tomb. They had it guarded. They knew where it was. They knew where his body was. All they had to do was bring the body out, pray through the streets of Jerusalem. Hey, he's not risen. It's right here. We got it. They couldn't do that, could they? So that, to me, the empty tomb, one of the strongest proofs for the resurrection of Jesus. Scriptures tell us there were over 500 eyewitnesses to his resurrection. The disciples, their lives were transformed. You know, after Jesus died, they're hiding, they're scared. But after his resurrection, they are preaching boldly in the temple, and they all gave their life for the fact of the resurrection. Transformed lives today, and then of course the existence of the church today, proof for the resurrection of Jesus. Let's close in prayer. Lord, we thank you that we serve a risen Savior and Messiah. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for your death and burial and resurrection, paying the price for our sin with your own blood. And may we share this wonderful news of a lost and dying world in your name. And we say, so come, Lord Jesus, and amen.
Amen.
That's probably number 6, 7, 2.